present. Want me to restart, Madam Secretary?
No, we do have sound now.
Okay. So House Judiciary is called to order, 125. Present for the record are Representatives Gruenberg, Guerra, Dahlstrom, myself, McGuire. The other members are on their way. So we have three items on the agenda today. I'm going to roll House Bill number 257 down to the bottom. We will bring up first House Bill number 92 by Representative Kelly, who's here, and then we're going to go ahead and begin testimony on Senate Bill 67 today. Not moving it out today, but beginning our lengthy testimony. So without further ado, Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate the opportunity to be here this afternoon. House Bill 92 is an act relating to the purchase of interests in corporations, including limited liability companies, by the University of Alaska. The University of Alaska has proven to be a valuable tool in Alaska's economic development and in a desire to allow the university to continue and even expand its vital role in this area. We propose a much-needed change in Alaska's corporate liability laws intended to protect the university from liability arising from the piercing the corporate veil concept. The piercing the corporate veil concept is a judicial process whereby the court will disregard the usual immunity of corporate entities from liability for wrongful corporate activities perpetrating fraud. They can then impose personal liability on stockholders, officers, and directors of the corporation in the case of fraud or other wrongful acts done in the name of the corporation. While this is generally a sound policy, however, in the university context, the application of this theory has the unintended consequence of discouraging university investment in new corporate endeavors resulting from intellectual property generated by faculty research. The university cannot support various types of economic development initiatives or associate with public groups through nonprofit corporations without the fear of liability under the piercing the corporate veil theory, which is quite liberal in Alaska as compared to many other states. In one such immediate example, the university rejected a 501c3 nonprofit corporation which would have led the Business Enterprise Institute because of a potential corporate veil liability. Likewise, the university has not been supportive of efforts by faculty members with intellectual property to start up corporations, recognizing that if liability were incurred by such a corporation, there would be a substantial risk that such liability could pass to the university. Kind of a tail wagging the dog sort of a concept. Our intent with House Bill 92 is to specifically define a university corporate liability structure intended to encourage new university investment in limited liability and nonprofit corporations resulting from research generated intellectual property or companies created and managed on university lands. And finally, Madam Chair, there are three different approaches typically used by universities to spin off companies. One of them is the hands-off approach, where the faculty member develops his or her own business plan, finds the venture capital funding, and pays all other costs of startup. And the university then has a second level of involvement, which is called the hands-on approach, where the university may actually review the faculty member's business plan and even go with them to help acquire venture capital, and may even provide a little bit of funding for the venture. Otherwise, it would be pretty much hands-off. With the up to your neck, or the third approach, the university puts together the business management team or provides a business incubator and provides substantial funding and other startup support. These approaches would be under the purview of the Board of Regents, which would have to approve any of these relationships. And universities that handle startups thoughtfully and well attract high energy, innovative faculty who in turn attract top-notch students. Students often tend to settle near the communities where they attended school. Startups can provide training grounds for students and valuable collaborators for university faculty, as well as provide economic development opportunities. And there, as I mentioned, there are several models for these relationships. And at the bottom line, Madam Chair, the president of the university has dramatically increased over-the-fence funding for our university for research, both applied and practical research in some cases. It's his strong desire to export that to the business community. There are several successful models of other universities doing this. This is one method that allows the university to get its feet wet in this area, and once again, it's under the control completely of the Board of Regents. Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll take questions.
Thank you very much. Okay, we just have one person online, Mr. Roger Bruner. And so I'll go ahead and, Mr. Bruner, are you there?
I am here.
Go ahead and take your testimony, and then we can ask questions of the bill sponsor.
I don't actually have any testimony. I was just available to answer questions, too.
Okay. So he's online as a resource. He's with the, as a resource, the University of Alaska.
Yes.
Okay. So questions for the bill sponsor, Representative Gruenberg?
Mr. Bruner is who?
He's with the University of Alaska.
General counsel.
Oh, he's the counsel. Okay.
Representative Gira.
So, Madam Chair, and Representative Kelly and I have been back and forth on this bill, and actually he narrowed it quite a bit since the last time. But for those of you who aren't versed yet in this sort of whole corporate veil concept, the nub of the bill is, or the nub of the potential problems with the bill, and I think we all want to encourage university research and prosperity. But if you look at page 1, line 14, that's the part where it says if the university obtains a nonprofit corporation as part of an effort to maybe promote some sort of economic activity or some other university purpose, if the university becomes part owner of a nonprofit company, it's not liable for the obligations of the company unless the university president signs an agreement saying they're liable. So there are two concerns I have. One is you purchase a nonprofit that has that owes money throughout the community, and the university is not liable at all to pay those obligations to the community members. Or after the university purchases an interest in the nonprofit, it garners debt all over the community again to vendors in the community, to maybe it wrongfully terminates somebody, maybe whatever liabilities it incurs. And then the university is still not liable. So it gets all the benefit of the corporation, but doesn't have to pay anybody. And presumably, if it's part of a nonprofit corporation, there are going to be other owners as well. And I guess my concerns would be alleviated somewhat if there was some sort of way to make sure the other owners would then not sort of shirk their responsibilities to the community. Maybe the other owners would have to prove that they have a bond or insurance to cover these things. But without that, I'm very uncomfortable having this business entity in the community that's able to, you know, purchase $500,000 worth of stuff from a local vendor and not be liable to ever pay the bills and or incur any sort of liability and never be held liable for it. So maybe a solution, I don't know what your thoughts are, maybe a solution is to say that the other owner has to sort of bond or insure to make sure that they're on the hook. But what are your thoughts?
I guess, I'll do this for just a moment, which will allow Roger, hello Roger, time to be thinking about the response to that, because I'd like you to weigh in as well. But I think that just as you say, it does protect the university from that liability. But remember, we're dealing with a corporate structure that it has invested in, and that very corporate structure sends warning to the community, to those involved, that this is a corporation, this is a limited liability arrangement. And I think if we try to reach over the fence and make okay what you're talking about, we'd risk the whole thing. But let me ask, if I might, Madam Chair, Council Bruner to weigh in.
Mr. Bruner, are you following the discussion?
Yes. As I understood the question, it was how could it be fair for the university to profit from a nonprofit corporation without being liable for its debts? And I think the first answer that comes to mind is nonprofit corporations are not allowed to have their members profit from the corporation. So the premise of the question I don't think would be there. I think Alaska statute and I think the IRS code both prohibit nonprofit members, well, nonprofit corporations from distributing their assets to members. A lot of nonprofit corporations in Alaska do not even have members at all. The statutes say you can either have them or not have them when you set up a corporation. But anyway, I think that it's fair for the university not to be held liable for the debts of a nonprofit because it is prohibited from profiting from nonprofit gains.
You understand? I mean, in essence, it's the venture capital.
Right. It would be putting up money to help the operation get off the ground, hopefully, but...
But it's not the profit, so why would you expect to have the losses if you don't have the profit?
Yeah, it's kind of similar to the state. It sets up lots of corporations, the Alaska Railroad, the Alaska Energy Corporation, lots of...
Or even like a silent partner or a passive capital investor.
Yeah, lots of entities, but then the state is protected, and you can't, if that thing fails, you can't go against the state general fund to try to collect on debts of one of these.
Representative Guerra?
Yeah, maybe I misspoke because I didn't really mean to say that the university was going to profit from a nonprofit. My question really was the university gets benefit, and maybe you interpreted the word benefit to mean profit, and I wasn't assuming that they were going to profit. So the question is, why is it fair to let the university benefit from being a part owner of this venture, but not have any obligation to pay any of the debts that the nonprofit incurs throughout the community? Most nonprofits, I mean, nonprofits aren't generally given the right not to pay people back when they incur debt. And I'm just looking for some sort of protection to all of the vendors that sell stuff to this nonprofit, to all of the people that contract with this nonprofit, to have somebody pay them back when they're owed money.
That is a little different question. I guess the answer to that is probably along the lines that Representative Kelly suggested, that the whole idea of having corporations and having a society where you allow corporations is to allow things to start up and encourage development by offering the protections of a corporation. What we're asking for here is just to protect the university from an exception to that general rule that all the states have decided is a good idea to allow corporations to have protection and limited liability for investment. The general rule is what you put in is all that's at risk. This piercing the corporate veil rule is designed to allow for limited exception to that rule. And the problem is that, as Representative Kelly said, in Alaska the rule has gotten to be quite broad in the courts, and it's just too dangerous, I guess, from the university's point of view, just as it would be for the state to do, to just say, okay, we're going to encourage this development by setting up another corporation to do this particular project. But if the rule is, well, if the money runs out, somebody who's owed money can go to the university or the state and ask for all their bills to be paid, even though they knew that they weren't dealing with the state or the university, they were dealing with a separate corporation. So it's really trying to put down in black and white ink in a statute the protection that corporations normally afford, and to avoid the risk of having to worry in each case that somebody who didn't get paid by a corporation is going to try to go around the normal protection, going to try to sneak under the fence and collect what normal corporate rules would not allow them to collect anyway, by somehow coming up with an argument that, well, gee, I should be an exception to the corporate protection. I should get paid even though my deal was with the Space Satellite Corporation, and they have now gone broke for whatever reason, and so I should get my money from the university just because it invested some startup funds in the project.
Well said, and that's the legal part of it. And the public policy part of it is that, you know, we eliminated the Alaska Science and Technology Fund, short-sighted move in my own personal opinion, but we did do that. And what you have now is a situation where you have a lot of young and some older entrepreneurs with really great ideas, futuristic ideas that have the potential to really change the face of Alaska and of the world, but they don't have the capital in many instances to invest. And so, you know, the public policy argument is that I think it's fair anyway that you not be expected to pierce the corporate veil beyond what the amount of money is that's invested. But if you wanted to, on some hand, think that it was unfair, I think the unfairness is outweighed by the greater public good of allowing for the investment. But I can already see where we're going here, so I'm going to set your bill aside until there's another vote for you. How's that?
Representative Guerra.
But
in fairness, I've got to...
In wrap up?
Well, in fairness. Okay. The statement that was just made in response to my last question is, why not let the university gain all the corporate protections that anybody else has? Why are we treating them differently? In all fairness, it's your bill that's treating them differently. If the university wants to be treated like any other owner of a corporation, then current corporate law would apply. You're the one that's seeking the exemption. You're the one that's it's the bill that is giving the university an exemption from having to pay debts that other owners of corporations would have to pay. And I guess we're talking around the corporate veil rule, but what is, and as I sit here, even though I've practiced law in the past, I don't know what the current corporate veil rule is, and so what is unfair about the current corporate veil rule that applies to every other corporate owner that the university wants to be exempted from?
Well, I guess the main difference is the size of the pocketbook. If I only had 10 bucks, I wouldn't worry about the corporate veil getting pierced too much because I'd lose my 10 bucks and that would be that. But if it's the university budget that's on the line, if I have to tell them that, well, there's a 5% risk that some judge someday may pierce the corporate veil on this, the bottom line answer has to be we can't afford that risk. If I had a smaller pocketbook, two things would be different. One, we wouldn't be worried about so much money, and two, we wouldn't have to worry because the plaintiff would not bother coming after us for the 10 bucks in a small pocket. It's the size of the budget, and that's, again, the reason that the state sets up these corporations separately and clearly disclaims liability itself. The general fund is not on the hook, just because if it was, you could expect every time a bill didn't get paid, the state would get sued.
Madam Chair.
Representative Guerra.
I'm not trying to slow things down. I know you're frustrated and you want to move ahead. Maybe I didn't ask the question well, but in order for us to create an exception to the corporate veil rule, I think we have to know what the corporate veil rule is. My question was, what is the current corporate veil rule and why is it unfair? And I think that got interpreted to mean how much money does the university have? So I do need to understand the bill if I'm going to pass it out.
Representative Groenberg?
Had Representative Guerra, I don't know if he'd finished his question yet.
It's now a statement.
Okay. I don't know much about... I'm never having practiced corporate law, to my recollection anyway. I'm looking at the spin-off company models for university by Diane McLean, and looking at the second paragraph from the bottom in this one-page handout that we all have. It says, typically universities that regularly enter into startups or have ownership in other corporations use a research foundation/corporation as the intermediary. and they come in all kinds of types. And I'm wondering if that could simply serve as the vehicle for insulating the university. And I'd ask Mr. Bruner through the chair about that.
Mr. Bruner?
The short answer is I don't know. I'm not familiar with that concept.
Well, before we pass a law that just insulates somebody from any kind of creditor or tort liability, because this also applies to a vendor situation, too. It's not just a tort liability thing. I would like somebody to answer this question and Representative Guerra's question. I think they're legitimate questions.
Okay, so we'll set House Bill
without
number
due respect to the,
to the side. And
because it may be very possible we can craft something, or maybe nothing has to be.
With 500 years, I bet we could do it on every single bill that comes through. Thank you, Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, so Senate Bill number 67. I think you're kind of here for that too, aren't you? Or not? Okay. All right, Senate Bill 67. Is there anybody from the sponsor's office that's going to? Okay, I guess not. So we'll just go to Mike Hogan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Mike Hogan. I am the Executive Director of Alaska Physicians and Surgeons, which is a medical association in Anchorage representing approximately 165 doctors, predominantly specialists. And I am here today in strong support of SB 67. And my part of this bigger puzzle is to relay to you some of the results of a poll that a coalition called Alaskans for Access to Healthcare, of which my association is part of, conducted last month. It was a statewide poll conducted March 8th through the 10th. Approximately 600 Alaskans were contacted on the issue of medical liability reform. And I'll go through some of the highlights of the poll for you. First of all, almost two-thirds, 64% of Alaskan voters were aware of the ongoing debate about medical malpractice liability reform and the corresponding increases in costs to physicians to obtain medical malpractice insurance. And the central findings of the poll are that approximately 60% of Alaskans are in favor of placing a cap of non-economic damages in medical liability cases. And that was an unaided question in the sense that it was not primed. We asked later in the poll or gave them a set of six facts about the state of affairs in Alaska and re-asked the question, and that number went from 60 to 67%. So there is strong support for this proposition. 72% of Alaskans voters feel that healthcare providers are doing an excellent or good job in preventing medical errors and promoting public safety. 58% of Alaskan voters feel that many or some physicians are performing additional tests or procedures that are not necessary to protect in themselves, but are done to protect themselves from frivolous lawsuits. Nearly half of Alaskans, 48%, feel that many or at least some physicians have stopped providing certain complex or high-risk medical services or refusing to treat patients with serious illnesses to protect themselves from lawsuits. On a practical level, and it actually makes sense in hindsight, we asked them, well, what led them to these fears? And predominantly voters or those polled fear that the medical malpractice insurance problem will have a direct impact on their lives in that it may bounce right back and hit them in their pocketbooks in the form of higher health care costs. 86% of those asked were very or somewhat concerned that they may have to pay more for health care costs. 72% fear not being able to find a specialist if they need one. 66% fear not being able to find a doctor when they need one. And four-fifths, or about 80%, are concerned that ultimately they may not be able to afford health care insurance, which is a little bit separate issue, but it ties in to their fears. As you will hear in later testimony from others, Alaska has a severe shortage of physicians. We rank near the bottom, I think 46th in the number of doctors per capita across the country. Those states that have enacted meaningful non-economic damage caps, on average, have seen about a 12% greater per capita number of doctors than those states that have not. And I'd just like to sum up by urging you to support SB 67, and I'm here to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hogan. Questions? Representative Gira and then Dahlstrom.
Hogan, I'm not going to make my decisions based on a poll, but let me figure out the validity of the poll. The poll started out asking people if they were in favor of placing a cap on non-economic damages. Is that correct?
The poll actually started off with a series of more general questions.
Let me make it quicker. But they were asked whether or not they were in favor of a cap. Is that correct?
Yes.
Were they told that there was a cap?
They were not told that, no.
I see. And that's really the only question I have about the poll.
Sam Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Vogan, thank you for being here today. Just a quick question. Are you a physician?
No, I am not.
And so your position with
I'm the executive director of Alaska Physicians.
Executive director.
And
okay, great. And also
Alaska Physicians and Surgeons.
Alaska Physicians Research.
And Surgeons.
Please don't interrupt. It confuses the record. Just be recognized the way everybody else does. I appreciate it. Representative Dahlstrom, please continue.
Mr. Hogan, are you at liberty to share the poll with us that I can look at the questions that were asked and the numbers?
Absolutely.
I would appreciate that. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
I apologize for messing up the record. That should reflect it was I. Is this the poll here?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
And there is a copy in your
through the chair. You're the executive director of Alaska Physicians and Surgeons. What is that organization?
It is an association in Anchorage, predominantly membered by the specialty community. We represent most of the larger medical groups in Anchorage: cardiologists, anesthesiologists, orthopedists, general surgeons. We have about 35 to 40 general or primary care doctors, of which OBGYNs are in that group.
And what is the purpose of the organization?
Part of the purpose of the organization is to do public policy advocacy, which we're doing today. Another function we have is we act as a buying group for the physicians. They get benefits being able to collectively go to the different vendors as a group, as opposed to individual offices.
Does this include malpractice insurance?
Other questions, Representative Gruenberg?
No, not at this time. I appreciate your handing out the survey so we can see the questions.
Any further questions for Mr. Hogan? Okay, thank you very much.
I do have one, I'm sorry. When was this survey done?
It was done, I believe, March 8th through the 10th.
Thank you very much. Okay. Next, I have Rod. Is it Bettit or Bettit?
Bettit sounds good.
Okay, my committee knows I usually pick the wrong pronunciation. So, if there's a way to pronounce it wrong, I'll figure it out. Welcome,
Madam Chair, members of the committee. The actual pronunciation is Beatty, and you'd never get it from that spelling. All my kids say Bettit, which is the more correct French pronunciation. So, you were closest. I'm here today on behalf of the members of the Alaska State Hospital Nursing Home Association. My testimony reflects what they want to express to you about this bill. Should be in your packet, and I'll just try to recap what those key points are. First one has to do with why my members are supporting Senate Bill 67. The primary reason is access. That there's a growing concern on their part working with physicians that more and more difficulties being experienced throughout the state in terms of physicians being available to see people for various medical problems that they have. And that seems to be even more serious in areas where there are specialty needs on the part of a person that requires a specialty physician to address that. And we know that we have shortages already in the state. We think that this bill will better balance the non-economic damage interest entitlement of an individual with the larger community concern of having enough physicians to meet everybody's medical needs, and that it would move us closer to having a medical liability law that would make that more reasonable and fair. I want to underscore that this does nothing to reduce the financial compensation for economic damages or punitive damages that an individual should receive and is appropriately awarded during any one of these actions that are brought against the medical community. Why do we need to act now? We believe that the literature is pretty compelling that premium increases without some kind of reasonable non-economic damages cap are a major contributor to a shortage of physicians. And there's certainly literature that would suggest otherwise, but we think the most compelling and credible literature would support the position that it is a big factor. If you look at our numbers, and you heard that we're 46th in the country in terms of the number of physicians per capita, that doesn't tell the whole story, because if you get underneath those numbers, you'll see that more and more physicians are limiting their practice and what services they'll offer because of malpractice liability and the cost to their practice to provide those other services. And I have an example from Soldotna where a particular OB, general practice type physician, had to limit his practice so that prenatal care and delivery were no longer made available to his patients. And that practice shrinking is happening throughout the state in other communities as well. Where a physician could elect to go ahead and continue to provide more services because it's available through their insurer, that's getting more challenging as well. And in other areas, other enterprises, you can raise your fees to collect more revenue to offset your cost of doing business. Physicians are very handicapped in being able to do that because so much of their business is either governed by Medicaid and Medicare, which makes up, you know, right now it's about 50% of the total healthcare system. But that is not something that Medicare and Medicaid recognize. When you submit higher charges, any increased fee that comes down the road at some point in time based on a formula they compute, and the physician has very little control over that. The other aspect is the number of people who cannot pay at all or for whom they provide charity care at the front end, and we have an uninsured rate in the state of about 20%. So there's very little ability for a physician to offset this through physician fee increases. If you look at the population for Alaska versus the expected growth in physicians, that's another concerning component of this. Total population of Alaska is projected to grow 28% by the year 2020. And there's a table in here, and I apologize that the numbers aren't clear, but if you go down to the scale on the left side of that scale, it shows Alaska, Region 10, and the United States, the total population increase. And during the years 1980 through the year 2000, it went up to 62%. It's projected to go up another 28% against a U.S. growth rate of 18%. If you look at the population 65 and older, Alaska experienced a 229% increase in the 20 years, you know, 1980 to the year 2000, and is expected to go up another 109% in the next 20 years versus the U.S. growth of about 53%. So we have a population growth issue that is going to be very significant in the next 20 years, and within that we have an aging population growth that's the largest in the country. So if we're 46th in the number of physicians per capita, 47th in the number of hospital beds per 100,000 population, and 49th in the number of nursing home beds for people 65 and older, we're going to be looking at this very large rate of growth in total population as well as the number of elderly within that growth, and requiring services by more specialty physicians who are the ones most impacted by this medical liability issue and are going to be in the poorest situation to attract those to our state. The numbers on what the physician growth rate looks like for Alaska are equally worrisome, and this is what the Bureau of Labor Statistics predicts for Alaska for the period 1996 to 2006. And if you note the physician category there, The Alaska solid black number shows a 1.9% rate of change. The U.S. shows 9.5% overall. And again, we need more physicians and we need more in certain specialties. And that kind of rate of change is not going to accommodate the kind of growth that Alaska needs. So it'll continue to be well down in the pack in terms of the number of physicians available, and even worse off in terms of the number of physicians for specialty areas. So in summary, we know we have a problem now. We know that it's going to get worse because the population is going to put increasing pressure on the physician community. We know that two-thirds of the public spending, public spending Medicare and Medicaid is for services to the elderly, that Medicare and Medicaid together represent 50% of total spending in this country. There's very little ability to recover any increased reimbursement through those programs, yet these are people who are going to have very serious prolonged illnesses in those programs that require a strong physician community to treat it. So we think that this increase in specialty physicians in those various fields needs to be addressed, and that the only way we're going to do that is keep our physicians in practice as long as possible, not having a medical school in the state or large residency programs, and by creating a fair medical liability environment to attract new physicians from outside the state. For those reasons, Madam Chair and the committee, our membership strongly supports this measure and encourages your support of it as well. And I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Beattie. And I just have one technical question. Region 10, did you say what that encompasses?
It's Idaho, Washington, Oregon, and Alaska.
Thanks, Mr. Beattie. That Bureau of Labor Statistics estimate of physician growth, it was 1996 to 2006. Was that made, I guess, in advance of 1996? That was their guess, or is that
yes.
Their?
Yes. And
I asked Legislative Research to give us information on physician growth in Alaska, and I'll share this with you. I've got an extra copy. For the 1996 to 2006, well, we don't have 2006 yet, right? From the 1996 to 2004 period, they say that, and they leave out federal physicians, and I will get to that. They say the physician numbers went from 1996, 1,593, to in 2004, 2,321. So that's an increase of about 50%, which indicates maybe the Bureau of Labor Statistics was wrong. Do you have, I guess, I'll say to you, I guess they leave out federal physicians for who knows why, for some reason, and they say, well, there's a footnote that explains why they leave it out and why it's not tabulated. And I don't know what the number of federal physicians has been in the federal facilities here, but it causes me some pause when there are arguments that the number of physicians has been going down, or suggestions. But according to the state numbers, they've not only been going up, but they've been going up per person. So in 1996, according to this chart, there were 2.6 physicians per 1,000 Alaskans, and now that's gone up to 3.54 physicians per 1,000 Alaskans.
Representative Guerra, through the chair, I really couldn't say for sure why the statistics are different. Clearly, you'd have to take a look at the methods behind them. But I suspect part of it is due that this data that you have is state-licensed physicians, not necessarily practicing. And the Bureau of Labor information is those that are employed and actually in the workforce, and that they make a stronger attempt to try to correlate the number of physicians in the state to the number that are actually providing services. And so I really couldn't go beyond that, though, in terms of trying to understand the differences between these two reports.
The only thing, according to the Legislative Research Report, and I don't know if this answers your question, but the numbers I just gave you were of active state-licensed medical doctors, not a combination of active and inactive. So they're only reflecting active physicians in the numbers I just gave you.
Representative Garrett, through the chair. Again, I can't speak to that. I don't know how accurate that is and how they gathered that information. So.
Any other questions for Mr. Bean? Thank you for your testimony. Yep. Okay, I have Kathy Giesel on the line. Kathy, are you there?
I am.
Just, we know who you are, but state your name and who you're affiliated with and offer your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Kathy Giesel. I'm an advanced nurse practitioner, and I'm speaking today on behalf of the Alaska Nurse Practitioner Association in support of SB 67. You've heard from my physician colleagues about the importance of this liability insurance bill and the impact that liability insurance rates are having on physicians in Alaska. My purpose in testifying today is to make sure that you're aware that not only physicians are being impacted by this, but also nurse practitioners. Now, you may be asking yourself, why would we care about nurse practitioners? So just briefly to raise your awareness, there are over 500 nurse practitioners in Alaska. We deliver primary health care services and provide access to care for Alaskans. More than 50% of us live and work in rural Alaska. So we're important providers. Our malpractice insurance rates have been increasing 30 to 50% annually over the last 2 to 3 years. Some premiums have tripled in 2005 alone, and we're told by our insurance carriers to expect this trend to continue. Now, you may hear that and say, well, sounds like you nurse practitioners are making some mistakes here because they're having to raise your rates. But in fact, the Department of Health and Human Services maintains a national practitioner data bank. This is a data bank of information that records license actions for practice areas, for practice errors, excuse me, for each area of the country. And Alaska's nurse practitioners over the last 15 years only had 3 license actions. In that same period of time, physicians had 143 actions against their licenses. So you can see that nurse practitioners are not making errors. We are not being found liable in malpractice suits. The increase in our insurance premiums is a reflection, a ripple effect from what is happening with physicians. And so this issue of tort reform is very important to us as well. We want to continue to provide healthcare services to Alaskans. So with that, I'll be brief. I want to thank you for allowing me to testify in support of SB 67.
Thank you, Ms. Giesel. Representative Gira.
Thanks, Ms. Giesel. Let me give you this. I guess I'm much more skeptical that if we limit the amount of damages people are allowed to recover when they're harmed, that insurance companies are going to start reducing premiums or stop increasing premiums so much. Do you have any information that if your premiums have been going up 30 to 50% a year, do you have any information whether that's because your liability judgments are going up 30 to 50% a year? And if not, why, by affecting somebody's ability to recover damages, do you think that insurance companies are going to stop increasing?
Representative Gareth, through the chair, I appreciate that question. That's a very good question. First of all, let me say that I don't think that this bill alone is the answer to malpractice insurance rates. It's a piece of the answer. It's also a piece of the answer to the cost of health care and access to health care in Alaska. But your question about evidence that it's had impact. And I have information here from Texas, who recently instituted a cap on malpractice claims. Prior to the cap, they had 17 insurance carriers. They dropped down to 2. They instituted the cap, and now there are 14 insurance carriers in that state. Their insurance rates dropped 12% after the first year after the cap was instituted, followed by another 5%. Now, this is data from the American Medical Association. We know that California's rates are 40% lower than Alaska's malpractice rates. I believe that part of the answer will be to hold insurance companies accountable after the institution of a more rigid cap to reduce those rates, because they'll no longer have the validity for causing these continuing increases. I don't feel that this is the total answer, but it's a piece of the answer. And doing nothing will certainly ensure that rates will continue to climb.
Representative Guerra?
Thanks, Kathy.
Any further questions? Okay, thank you so much for your time, Kathy.
Thank you.
Okay, next I will go to Doug Johnson. Right here.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Doug Johnson. I am with the Alaska Academy of Trial Lawyers. I am a lawyer, but I don't do medical malpractice claims as a rule. In fact, I can say I don't think I've ever earned or received a penny of income from any medical malpractice case. I don't know the ins and outs of medical malpractice, but what I can talk about today is my thoughts on the appropriateness of a cap on the non-economic damages. I live out in Chugiak. I work with a lot of youth groups out there, the Boy Scouts and some folks from church, and often I'm called to talk about laws and how laws are made and what the purpose of laws in our society are for. We talk to the youth about personal responsibility. We talk to them about justice and fairness for everyone. And, Madam Chairman, I cannot harmonize this bill with those principles. You can't harmonize a bill that restricts the damages that a person is entitled to receive artificially based on evidence that has nothing to do with the facts of the specific case and yet call it fair. Personal responsibility means if you break something, you fix it. And it doesn't matter if it's something that's less expensive or more expensive, you take care of what you've done. You make it right. This bill artificially shields people for creating greater harm. It takes away their responsibility for harm created. This bill disproportionately affects people in our state who have little to say in their representation, the very young children, the very old, our elders. It disproportionately affects those who have a subsistence lifestyle, because what it says is the only people who are entitled to be fully compensated are those who have damages of economic losses. But people that can't show large economic losses are not entitled to full compensation for the losses which they suffer. That is not fair, and it's not just, and it is not appropriate to discriminate against those folks. This bill violates the right to trial by jury. Somehow, if passed, we would be saying that we do not trust the citizens of this state to make correct decisions on placing values on damages or harm done to people through other people's mistakes. Now I recognize that folks who are working on this bill are trying to do good things. They have good purposes. But I think that they are severely mistaken in their foundations upon which they base what they're trying to do here. I think all the members of the committee have received the information packet. I'm not going to go through the entire thing because it's fairly long. But I will say that statistically throughout the nation, whenever there has been reform of the laws affecting the damages that someone can receive, often it's heralded as something that's going to reduce insurance premiums. And frankly, until just a minute ago, I had not heard of this being successful anywhere in reducing premiums. Now, apparently it's happened in Texas. I would like to look at that data because I don't have it. I can't comment on it. But I do know that in the other states where this has taken place, insurance premiums have not gone down, according to the information that I have. There's been talk about the number of claims here, and yet statistically, by the Alaska State Medical Board, information shows that the amount paid out in total damages over the last 10 years, actually between 1993 and 2003, when adjusted for inflation, has stayed exactly the same. And this is for total damages. There has been no change. There has been no rise or dramatic rise, as we've heard talk about. Basically, Madam Chairperson, I cannot harmonize this bill with the principles that I think we all espouse as being just and appropriate and part of what we are supposed to be about here. Thank you.
I appreciate your testimony sincerely. And there are completely two different perspectives on it, and I think you hit the nail on the head when you said it's good people trying to reach a solution with just different philosophies. On the subject of fairness, I guess I see your point, and then I look around particularly for women in some of the smaller communities like Juneau and others that don't have access to an OBGYN, to some of our elderly who have who are more inclined, even elderly men, even statistically, to heart problems and don't have access to a cardiologist, particularly in the case of an emergency. They might have access if they could get on a plane and had the time to do so. I look at some of our young people that suffer from head injuries, the highest rate in the nation of head injuries, that need immediate access to neurosurgeons that don't have that. And I wonder how fair that is. And I wonder if you would just take a second to address that part of it.
Absolutely. I think those are the very persons whose interests we ought to be looking out for here, because it's those young people with those traumatic head injuries that will suffer disproportionately under this bill. If there's not an earnings history, then there's not a large wage loss claim that can be made for that person. And yet that person will suffer throughout the rest of their entire life, and we will say that a cap of $250,000 is just an appropriate compensation for those types of injuries, which are created outside of the medical world and also inside. And it is not appropriate to say that if it happens with inside the medical field, there should not be appropriate and just compensation. As far as OBGYNs, I understand that the numbers have increased over the last several years, not decreased. And that information, again, is in the packet. And as I said before, I don't know all the ins and outs of medical malpractice types of claims. But apparently, there are more OBGYNs here in the state than there were 2 years ago. They haven't gone down. And I again submit that reducing the amount of what injured people can receive for full compensation and just compensation will do nothing to affect how many doctors are here. I don't think the statistics back that up.
And then the only other question I want to ask you on the record is, you know, I believe it's a community responsibility that we have right now to address the problem, and we're coming at it from different perspectives. I think it's healthcare providers' responsibility, policymakers' responsibility, insurance providers' responsibility, and I also think it's trial lawyers' responsibility too. And I want to ask you something that has been discussed to me by constituents and people over the years is that when you go on a contingency fee basis and at the end of this road that you go down trying to recover compensation, that many times after the contingency fee is taken out, often as high as 40%, and excluding costs of things like expert witnesses, copying fees, travel, and so on, that the person is really left with about 50% of what the jury, again, the very people that you say are the experts and that we should trust, has awarded them. And I guess my question is, do you think that your profession bears any responsibility at all? And if so, what are your solutions in that arena?
I think that the profession bears the responsibility to do everything they can to try to protect these injured folks. And in order to do that, you've got to have people who are willing to invest the 2 or 3 years of time into actively pursuing something for which there's a 50-50 chance or less that they will ever have any compensation for it whatsoever, and at the same time investing their own funds to make it happen. I think that absolutely the profession bears responsibility to make sure that these innocent victims are not left out, those who don't have a voice right now, those who don't have many, many, many dollars backing their activities here in Juneau. They don't have a voice. And so, yes, absolutely, I agree, Madam Chair. We have a responsibility to protect them equally along with the rest of the citizens of the state. I agree.
You didn't answer my question. I mean, you keep going back to basically the same statement, and that's fine. I won't belabor it, but you really didn't answer my question. You reiterated the same statement you made at the beginning, which is that you believe there are people who this change would be unfair to, and I agreed from the outset that that's a position. But now I'm asking you, do you believe your profession itself bears any responsibility in looking at a fix to the crisis we have right now, which is escalating healthcare costs, escalating medical malpractice rates, decreasing number of specialists, particularly in areas where we need them, and an escalating population base? That's my question to you, not just the part of your testimony that you alluded to, which is that the reason you became a trial lawyer, for fairness and all those things. Mm-hmm. Do you believe, for example, that anything needs to be done in the area? Some states have gone the route of capping, for example, compensation rates for medical malpractice claims. I mean,
because I don't practice in that area, it's hard for me to address specifically to medical malpractice. But my thought on that, Your Honor, is that I think there is a, well, I can tell you this much. I know that when someone calls me who has been seriously injured through some sort of medical negligence, and I go to refer them to someone, it's very difficult to find in this state an attorney who does that. I can think of about, well, I suppose I could come up with more if I thought long and hard about it, but I can think of about 5 attorneys, maybe 10, that I can refer to. And that's because of the incredible difficulty of bringing a medical malpractice claim. By capping, and I assume what the chair is alluding to is capping the fees that those attorneys could charge, I think that what would happen then is that the only people who would have access to appropriate representation, legal representation, are those who could find a different way than paying other than through contingency fees, and which would effectively mean that these folks who don't have a voice now would have less of a voice then.
Final question, though, does it trouble you that these very people that you're talking about in many cases often end up with only 50% of what a jury said that they were entitled to make them whole?
The incredible costs involved in bringing these claims is troubling. From a personal point of view, I can certainly tell you that. They are extremely expensive to bring these cases. And the defenses arrayed against those claims are huge, and the amount of funds that they have to bring to bear to fight against those claims is enormous and almost without bounds. And so, yes, absolutely. The fact that it costs so much to actually pursue a claim against the forces that are arrayed against it is troubling. I agree, Your Honor.
Representative Kara.
One comment, one question. I think we'll distribute this to everybody, but it seems like the amount of payouts, the amount that insurance companies have paid for malpractice settlements and judgments is about the same now as it was in 1993, yet insurance rates keep going up. So there was a statement before about escalating liability, and I don't think that there's any evidence of escalating liability. Doug, let me ask you, I do a terrible job at this. The last couple of years this bill has come up, and I try and explain what non-economic damages are. And some people think they're punitive damages. I can never explain to people that that's not the case. But can you explain what non-economic damages are and how that's different than punitive damages?
I will try. First of all, punitive damages are supposed to be a civil form of basically a criminal-type punishment, sanctioning someone for what they've done wrong. It has nothing to do with the amount of harm they have done to an individual or the compensation that person needs to be made whole. This bill addresses the general damages. General damages are those that we say, this is the loss a person has incurred. This is what has been taken away from them because of what happened. And this amount that we allow for non-economic damage. It's supposed to make up for that part of the losses which aren't reflected in exact dollar signs. For example, a young person who, and speaking in general tort sense here, is severely burned through someone's negligence, who will have to go through the rest of their life deformed and in great pain. Economic damages do not cover that. They cover the amount of the doctor's bills. They may cover the amount of the physical therapy. If you can show a loss of earnings in the future, they would cover those losses, but pay nothing for what the suffering of that person will be. Non-economic damages are supposed to cover those losses. What is the value of being able to hug your spouse? What is the value of being able to enjoy being with your children and to run and play with them? What is the value to be able to go fishing? What is the value to be able to go hunting and provide for your family? Those are, generally speaking, non-economic damages. And that's what those types of damages are supposed to compensate for if those abilities are taken away. Does that answer you? It's not a great answer. I should have thought more about that.
He knew what the answer was. He wanted it for the record.
He used the exact same.
Can you help me out? What else do you want me to say?
I understand that. I can never explain that to the other members. So thanks.
Maybe I would put it this way. If I had a painting that was of great worth to me individually, but say was bought for $10 originally, I don't know, and somebody broke that painting, the loss wouldn't be the cost of the glass that covered it or the frame around it, but it, in order to be fair and just, would have to include what value that had to me, which could never be replaced. And so it's trying to put a dollar figure on these sufferings that people have that you can't have an economist testify as to what it's worth.
I think, you know, the inherent problem is if something like that happens to you, there's no amount of money in the world that's going to make it right. I mean, there isn't enough money in the world. So.
And that is true, and yet in our system, under our Constitution, it's the money that has to be put up to try and make it right. No longer we go by an eye for an eye or a tooth for a tooth. It's the money that's supposed to replace it. And to say that it's tough to figure out how much that is, and so we aren't going to do it anymore, is not correct.
Appreciate your testimony, and I appreciate your I guess disclaimer in the beginning that the folks that are here to testify in opposition to your argument, which is to defeat the bill, are here with good intentions. And I think we're all trying to find common ground and work on a solution to this. I wanted to ask you a couple questions. One is, you talked about fairness and justice and other almost philosophical yearnings that you have in your opposition to the bill. You didn't mention, though, in terms of your opinion, if you think the current values, the current caps are fair. I mean, if you had your druthers, would you raise them even higher?
Your Honor, in response, I would just say, if I had my druthers, I would leave it to a jury of my peers to decide what my injuries are and what my losses are. And I trust the citizens of this state, wherever they may be, to make those decisions in their various communities more than what we can do here without any of the specific facts of a specific case in front of us.
So you, just through the chair, so you wouldn't have a cap, you just leave it to the jury?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And then secondly, with respect to Representative McGuire's question, that would be an interesting one for you to bring back and Melissa to look at. We've talked about, and I hope you understand, I think, the chair's mindset, because I share it, which is, if we are looking at insurers and we're looking at hospitals and we're looking at doctors and we're looking at all those related practitioners and entities and companies, and we're saying there has to be a fix, but it can't be, in this case, in a capping of the claim. Isn't it fair that the attorneys who have fees, and I've worked I can name the three firms I worked in Anchorage, but I won't on record, certainly worked on many, many personal injury cases, and I'm aware of the fees and the costs and the charges that are, you know, basically translated and pushed on to the client. It would be fair maybe to bring that back to them and ask if they would be willing to, in our negotiations and debate on this bill, have a cap. So that's a comment, and to follow Representative Guerra, then the question would be, where do you think the fix is? Because you said you understand that, you know, with the folks that have come to testify ahead of you, that you see there's a problem, but you don't think this is the fix. Hey, let the jury decide. We think that there's still, in terms of doctors, there could be more specialists. We talked about traumatic brain injuries. And we want to see workers, in terms of the insurance rates for doctors, at least reasonable so they don't depart. And it seems like more and more are retiring or we're not recruiting enough, and we all want good health care. Do you have an opinion on where you think the fix would be if it's not, as President Bush and others have said, what this bill is asking?
And for clarification purposes, I did not say I agree there's a problem, because I do not. I agree that there are good folks working on what they consider or have perceived to be a problem. I do not agree there is one. I think the basis for those opinions is false. And I think statistically that's backed up.
Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Through the chair, I'd never heard of the term hedonistic damages. Is that a term of art?
Oh, boy.
Has that been cited in courts of this state?
You know what? I'm going to have to plead not innocence but ignorance on this one. I'm not going to be able to give you a specific definition of what that is. I've never used that. I'm sure it is, and people much smarter than I'm sure use it, but I better not even comment.
I would be grateful if you could maybe get us something in writing in answer to that question.
I'll be happy to.
And I'd ask the bill sponsors or folks on the other side to get me. I've never heard that, and I've never seen that before in any legislation.
Moving on to other witnesses or more. Representative Guerra?
Yeah, I'm not going to take time with this. Representative Anderson, I'll get you a memo I got from legislative research. You asked what another alternative would be, and frankly, I think the best alternative, and it'll be in a memo that I got from research, which still needs a lot more work on it, but we used to have a medical insurance pool in the state. The last time there was a medical liability problem in the state and there weren't enough insurers, the state said, okay, we'll create a pool also. And roughly half the physicians of the state bought into the state pool, which actually made money for the state. It was profitable enough that at some point it was purchased by NorCal. There was another problem with it, the way it was set up. There was a tax issue that you'd have to work on. But the state could help create a pool so that if there weren't enough insurers, and right now there are two major insurers and I think something like 20 other smaller insurers that are writing malpractice coverage in the state. The memo will talk about that. But I think, frankly, a working group to recreate a pool so that there was a place where doctors could buy liability insurance if in the ebb and flow of private insurers in the state there was a bottoming out at some point, it would be the wise way to go. We'd do it the way we did it in the 1970s. I think it lasted about 10, 15 years. I'll get the
memo. Through the chair, then I hope that Alaska trial lawyers write a letter in opposition to that, because it's their representative has testified that there's no problem. So.
Okay, good point. On the record, everybody's supposed to have a Black's Law Dictionary. I gave you all one. But hedonic values? Okay.
Hedonistic. I use that term all the time, but not, you know.
That's right. Damages that attempt to compensate for the loss of the pleasure of being alive. Such damages are not allowed in most jurisdictions. Also erroneously termed hedonistic damages. So the correct is hedonic, H-E-D-O-N-I-C. Okay?
Repeat that. Damages that attempt to?
That attempt to compensate for the loss of the pleasure of being alive. Such damages are not allowed in most jurisdictions. Also termed erroneously hedonistic damages. Okay. Thank you very much.
I should
okay,
bring my
next. I'm going to go to folks online. I have Donna McCready. Ms. McCready, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. This is Donna McCready. I'm also a member of the Alaska Academy of Trial Lawyers and the Alaska Action Trust. I am a plaintiff's lawyer. I do some medical malpractice, and so I would like to talk a little bit about the logistics of doing medical malpractice cases on behalf of plaintiffs. I want to echo what Mr. Johnson said. I totally agree with him. When I was listening to testimony, my focus has been on what about personal responsibility? What about justice? And I think as the members of the committee have heard, we actually have damages caps in this state. They're $400,000 for non-economic damages for physical injuries, and it's $1 million for permanent severe physical injury or severe disfigurement. So we already have caps, and I have to say I'm mystified about the amount of energy, money, resources being spent to further lower the cap on non-economic damages in this state. And actually, the real effect of this legislation is not just to lower the amount of non-economic damages that a citizen in Alaska could be compensated if they prove that they were harmed by a doctor's negligence, seriously harmed by a doctor's negligence. It really denies access to justice completely for certain groups of people. For children, one. Stay-at-home moms, two. The elderly. People who are near retirement or retired. For Alaskan Natives who are living a subsistence lifestyle. And as Mr. Johnson eloquently explained, that's because those folks are not, they're not high earners. They are not wage earners. So they are essentially cut off from the justice system, no matter how badly no matter how bad the conduct is, that hurts them. So the way this bill is written and given the vote in the Senate, a doctor who's grossly negligent, a doctor who is reckless, a doctor who intentionally harms a patient, the non-economic damages available to the patient who's able to prove, again, you have to prove that the doctor engaged in that conduct and then that caused serious harm, their non-economic damages are capped at $250,000. The practicality is that because these cases are so expensive, and actually, if you talk to people on the street and you ask them, well, gee, you know, how would you think the system should work? How should the system work where if somebody thinks that they're harmed by a doctor, what they would actually have to do to prove that? Well, you have to prove that the doctor was negligent, again, grossly negligent or reckless. And the way you do that is you have to hire expert physicians who are working in the same area as the doctor you're saying was negligent or the healthcare provider that you're saying was negligent. And to do that, it's really quite expensive because you have to go to the lower 48 and hire experts. And you can't hire bad experts. You got to have good experts. You got to have people of credibility who have credentials, who know what they're talking about. And those folks, you can't even bring a case unless you have those folks saying, yeah, you know what, this is what the standard of care is. This is how doctors should behave under these circumstances and in such a case. And this doctor, you know, did not meet that standard, in fact, breached that standard, and that doesn't end there. You have to prove that that breach of the standard actually caused the harm, and it's got to be serious harm. Otherwise, it's essentially not worth it to bring somebody to court, because there are a lot of risks for plaintiffs who go to court. So if you told folks that that's how the system works, they would probably say, you know, that sounds about right to me. You should be able to have to prove that a doctor was negligent. You can't just say they're negligent. It's not good enough to just have a bad outcome. You actually have to prove the conduct, that something happened that caused somebody serious harm. And it should be risky. Folks who bring these kinds of cases, they should be facing some risk. And in fact, they do. Because in this state, if you are a plaintiff and you are not a prevailing party, which is a pretty technical term, you could be at risk of having a judgment against you. So your life could be ruined by somebody else's negligence or wrongdoing. And at the end of the day, you know, there's a risk if you go to trial and you're not the prevailing party that you could end up owing costs and fees. And I actually compiled some information for the House last year that showed that, in fact, medical malpractice cases, doctors are not shy about getting judgments against their patients who have sued them and have not prevailed. So there's a lot of risk involved in these cases, and that's why there's really not very many of us who are willing to take these cases on. And I will tell you, if the cap is passed, then there's a number of people that I just simply could not represent because economically it wouldn't make any sense for them. Anticipating the question about fees, I would like to speak to that. My people that come to me, they are not generally people who have a lot of power and clout. They are generally people who don't have a lot of economic resources. And so for me to take a case on, it's actually a really big investment monetarily and time-wise for my firm. So I may take on a case, and I may spend a lot of money on a case and then realize that I really can't go forward with it because we're not going to be able to prevail or the client doesn't want to take the risk or for whatever reason, and I'm out whatever money we've spent and whatever time I've spent. My fee agreements are usually a third plus cost. I definitely compromise my fee under certain circumstances. I do that because I really do want to do what's fair. But with the amount of investment of time and resources that I put into cases, I think it's not unfair for me to be compensated for the work I do. I'm really operating as a private attorney general. People come to me, and I can't afford to just take cases just because, somebody thinks they sound good. They really have to be cases where people are really seriously injured and the conduct on the part of the medical professional is really quite serious. So I view myself as a private attorney general. I think that if doctors realized how much time I spend explaining to people who think they've been harmed by negligence that maybe they really weren't, they might be surprised by that. I spend a lot of time educating the population about, it's really not appropriate to see your physician just because you think that you were harmed. You really have to prove that somebody did something wrong. It's not good enough to have a bad outcome. I was struck by, what the nurse practitioner said, and I'm actually very sympathetic with the doctors because they really, just like lawyers, they have to deal with their insurance companies. They're not the only ones who have their insurance rates going up at quite a rapid rate. The fact is there's absolutely no connection between payouts in malpractice cases and doctors or healthcare provider premiums. Just like there's really no connection between the increase in rates for lawyers and the malpractice payouts for lawyers. We're all dealing with the same problem, and other people can speak to it more eloquently than I can. But with the insurance industry, I mean, they go in cycles. And the big increase in premiums that we're all seeing, and it's not just healthcare providers, is the downturn in the market. I mean, the insurance companies had to make up for some either bad investments or just investments that didn't pay off after the economy suffered. And so that's really what we're seeing here. And so I would go back to what Representative Guerra said. In the 70s, there was a solution to this problem. It was MICA, not to be confused with MICRA in California, but it was a Medical Indemnity Corporation Act in Alaska that actually allowed doctors to self-insure in the state. And my understanding is that was very successful. And I think that would be something if there is a problem with malpractice premiums, that would be something that should be looked at. I guess I want to end with just a couple of things. I mean, I would just like the committee to really think about, when I look at this bill that lowers non-economic damages to $250,000, I think, well, why don't you guys just pass a bill to say, you know what, we are not going to allow certain Alaskans to sue doctors, period. We're going to immunize doctors from certain lawsuits, because that's essentially what you're doing. Because of the economics of these cases, there are just large groups of people in the state are just not going to be able to have access to the court system, no matter how badly they're hurt and no matter how bad the conduct is that hurts them. And so, you know, by putting this cap on, it sounds to people like, oh, well, we're capping damages and people can still collect for non-economic damages, but I just think that's really not it's really not the reality with this bill. And then I would also ask you, who benefits from this? Who benefits from this bill? Because I will tell you, healthcare providers will not benefit from this bill, and the citizens of Alaska will not benefit from this bill. I think the only group I can think of that will benefit would be the insurance companies And so I would conclude my testimony with that. And I do appreciate the time that you've allowed me to speak.
Thank you, Ms. McCready. Appreciate your testimony. Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two lines of questioning I'd like to ask you. Ms. McCready?
Yes.
Do you believe that there will be, well, what I want to do is explore the effect on frivolous lawsuits or non-meritorious lawsuits of the new bankruptcy law. In other words, if somebody in the past sued, took a gamble and lost, they could just, to escape the attorney's fees award against them, take bankruptcy. But now they can't do that, or can't do it as easily as they could.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if you would have any comments on whether you agree with that statement, and if so, whether you think that might, in effect, have a real deterrent effect on non-meritorious lawsuits in the future.
Well, I have to confess, I'm not an expert on the new bankruptcy law, although I certainly haven't read it. I've done a little bit of reading about it, and yeah, it is my understanding that it fairly radically changes the bankruptcy system, and certain debts that were able to be discharged in the past are not going to be able to be discharged. I guess first I would have to say that, you know, if there are frivolous lawsuits, medical malpractice cases being filed, they're generally probably not being filed through attorneys or attorneys with experience doing medical malpractice, because you just can't afford to file them. So perhaps there are some pro se clients out there who are filing lawsuits, but I would generally state that they're not going to be in court for very long, and I don't know if they would, because they don't have an attorney, they may not even understand that they're subject to Rule 82 fees. So I don't know what effect it would have on quote-unquote frivolous lawsuits. Are there people bringing lawsuits that are, this is my concern about this, I mean, are there people that are bringing lawsuits that are judgment-proof? Yeah, maybe, but think about the middle-class person who brings a lawsuit and then is so chilled by Rule 82 because they can't, you know, they're so afraid to go to trial because they could end up with a judgment against them, and they can't. They can't even claim bankruptcy, but they could lose what little that they have. I'm sorry, I'm kind of going far afield. Yeah, so it seems to me that the new bankruptcy law, from my understanding of it, would create even more of a problem, because folks who may be able to discharge their debt of attorney's fees or judgment against them in the past may have been able to wipe that clean. But, see, I don't know that. But frankly, I don't know that many people that are willing to take on into bankruptcy, whether or not they felt like they could discharge those debts or not. I mean, the people that come to me that I've always dealt with, boy, that's not something that they would ever take on lightly. I'm sorry if I haven't answered your question.
Well, that's all right. Okay. I'd like to move to the second area I was going to ask. That was a long answer to a short question.
I apologize.
No, that's all right. The second question, as I recall, you testified very briefly that you acted, the plaintiff's bar in this area acts in some sense as little attorneys general. And what that's kind of a shorthand for those of us who understand what you mean. What that means is basically it helps keep healthcare providers who shouldn't be practicing out of the practice. And I understand, I think, what you mean. As I understand it, if a person has a number of successful medical malpractice cases brought against them or settled against them, that can be utilized as evidence to the medical board to take disciplinary action against that person's license, and saves the state considerable money in the investigation of those licensed disciplinary actions. Isn't that correct?
That's correct.
Would you like
I
to say?
I think that's correct. And then in a broader sense, it's true that if let me explain to the committee. If I bring a lawsuit against a doctor, and actually a lot of people in the community don't understand this. If I bring a lawsuit, I'm not going to be able to, in that one particular lawsuit, be able to somehow affect that doctor's license directly. It may be that because of the resources that myself or my firm is spending on investigating a claim and a doctor's conduct or a healthcare provider's conduct or institutional conduct, it may bring to light certain practices that need to be examined. And certainly I'm saving the state the money by doing that and bringing it to their attention. And so, yeah, I'm not going to be able to personally take a license action against the doctor, but the work that I do certainly can save the state money and give the state important information.
May I inquire along that line? Ms. McCready, are doctors required to carry medical malpractice insurance? Because healthcare providers?
Well, I to tell you the truth, Representative Grunberg, I thought that they were, but then I hear some people saying that they're not. So my understanding is they were required to carry insurance, but I've also heard folks say that they're not required to carry it.
Representative Gruber, we have a physician that can.
Well, let me tell you where I'm going.
No better. Thank you.
Okay, maybe I'll save my question for that. Because it seems to me if the insurance industry did a little policing, maybe they could solve this problem.
Okay, any other questions? Seeing none, thank you, Donna.
Thank you.
We'll go next to, let me do this in order here. We'll go to Paul Dillon, who is in the audience, I presume, and then we'll go to Pat Luby from ARP, Kathy Dale, and then wrap it up with Dr. Reiner. I always pronounce his name wrong. He's going to slap me. And then I think that's it for folks.
Good afternoon. My name is Paul Dillon, and I am with the firm of Dillon and Finley. We have offices in Juneau and in Anchorage. We do medical malpractice in our Anchorage office. We do medical malpractice across the state. In addition to that, our attorneys do a variety of different practices. Mine specifically is insurance. I represent insureds against insurance companies. That's taken the form of class action work over the last 7 or 8 years, and that's pretty much my approach in terms of my testimony today. The question is, and I think the chair asked, is there a problem? Senator Seekins put it, is there a crisis? And if you look at the Division of Insurance and the materials put out by the Division of Insurance, they don't think there's a crisis at this point. The Division of Insurance has studied as part of the Tort Reform Act for the last 3 years. They've studied the effects of tort reform when we put the caps at 400,000. They've issued reports on a yearly basis. Those reports, I think, are fairly clear that at least as far as the carriers are concerned, we do not have a problem. We are a small market, which I'll address later. That of necessity means that we have certain problems similar to some other Western states. But at least insofar as the availability of insurance and the affordability question, if you ask any of the physicians who come before you, I suspect that they're going to testify that, yes, there is insurance available to them, issue one, and two, I can afford it given my practice. Now, the chair is very interested in contingency fees, and I'll be happy to address that later on, but let's set the stage here, folks. We are talking about physicians who are making 6 to 7 figures every year. Translated in Irish, that means hundreds of thousands or potentially a million or more in this state. Now, what we're also talking about on the other end of this equation in terms of what bill you're seeking to, who you're affecting by this bill, you're talking kids, moms, and the elderly. Now, I'm sorry if you've got a problem with lawyers or trial lawyers, but kids, moms, and the elderly aren't going to come and testify before you.